And I'd like to introduce our guest speaker for the night, which is Kathy L., and she'll be speaking on her story and her experience with the steps.
Hi, everybody. My name is Kathy Lawrence, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic. My home group is the Carry This Message group here in West Orange. Yay! And my sobriety date is January 1st, 1991. That's what I was taught and told to give, that I have a home group, that I do have a sobriety date, and who I am. And one of the reasons I tend to give my full name is in the rooms, the traditions talk about anonymity, and it talks about anonymity at the level of press, radio, and television. And I believe that. But in the rooms, I don't believe that we need to be quite so anonymous that we can't find each other. And I think that's important sometimes, that we don't know who each other are. I've had the experience of going to the hospital to go visit somebody, and it's like, can I meet? I don't know who they are. You know, I was lucky. The person I was going to meet, I knew her last initial, and she had a Polish name that was about 7 feet long. So they were able to find her. But, I mean, I remember that happening, and it was like, we're too anonymous sometimes, I believe. Anyhow, that's why I give my full name. Not for any other reason, but so that I could be found. My story is not particularly interesting. It's kind of ordinary. My first drink was about 6 months old. My mom used alcohol as a numbing agent when I was teething, and her comment to me was, "You smiled an awful lot after that one." One should know that there's a problem coming. Alcoholism is not a big issue in my family. I didn't grow up with it. My parents weren't. There are some family members somewhere sprinkled in there that probably have had a problem here and there, but I didn't grow up with it, and I didn't really start drinking in any way that was alcoholically until I really hit college. That doesn't mean that my behavior in my early life was sane and sober either. You know, it's like I don't know. I just never, Brenda talked about not fitting in, and I guess I felt a lot like that at times. I was the chameleon. You know, it's like I would make myself fit anything. And I was proud of that. I thought that was an asset. This is not a character defect. At that point in time, I thought it really was an asset that I could hang out with any of the groups, and I was whatever you wanted me to be or whatever group I was with. Suffice it to say that I didn't find out who I was until I got into AA, for the most part. I mean, I was what everybody else wanted me to be, or I tried to be. The one thing I knew I was confused. So I also had extremes. I mean, I didn't do anything. And I didn't play around in the middle. I went from one end to the other. I remember being in college, and I wanted to be a doctor. So I'm in a pre-med course, and I'm taking all these pre-med courses. My degree is in theater arts. I go from one extreme to the other, you know, from the science all the way over to the arts. It just in a lot of things, you know. It's like I always felt I was being picked on, or I wasn't good enough. What we all tell, you know, what I think almost all of us have gone through that to some extent or another. You know, I don't fit in. I don't. I'm not good enough. If they only knew who I was, and I carried that through for a long time. When I got into college, I found alcohol on a more than a medicinal basis. And because I did have alcohol through my life, you know, medicinally, my parents did do that. We were an alcoholic, and that worked for my mom, and it worked how she grew up. And that seemed to be okay. And I was the good little girl. That's what I played. That was one of the roles that I played. I was the good little girl who got good grades. I got to college, and nobody's looking over my shoulder. I nearly flunked out my freshman year because I was having fun. I mean, I didn't really get into a lot of that stuff until a little bit later, but I just felt like nobody, you know, I had a clean slate. Nobody knew who I was, so I can do anything I wanted. After my freshman year, I ended up, that's when I started moving into the theater arts. I had met some people, And I was doing that extracurricularly, and then I said, well, this is more fun. I don't have to go to class. I never learned how to study, and studying, I wasn't a good studier. I still am not. I do, but I don't sit down and learn from books well. So when I got into the theater, I found, oh, well, I can go and design sets, and I can design lights, and I can act, and I can stage manage, and I can direct, and I can do all these things, and I don't have to sit down with a book and take a test. And so that's one of the reasons why I ended up in the theater. In my college days, I did, you know, there were other substances, but after I left, it was like, that was one of the things in my first step that I found out about, like, am I a real alcoholic? You know, what, just where am I powerless? What is it? How do I know that I'm an alcoholic? I know I'm an alcoholic. I had surrendered a long time before I knew about this stuff. But I know I'm an alcoholic because when I start drinking, I don't know when I'm going to stop. And when I'm not drinking, that's all I think about. So I have both the mental obsession and the physical allergy. I didn't have that with the other substances I was playing with. You know, I mean, I got to a point where, gee, this doesn't feel so good. You know, this isn't so good for me. I liked the way it made me feel. I thought it was terrific. But I knew somewhere in my head that it wasn't good for me. So I said, okay, I'll stop. I was also cheap, too. They cost more. But, you know, that really was it. It wasn't, I mean, I don't think, if I'm a real addict, I would have kept going and, you know, the heck with the checkbook and everything else. I would have figured out a way to do it. And that's how I know, that's how I know the difference. And I really am an alcoholic and I am not a drug addict because I don't think about them. You know, I mean, when I think about it, it's sort of with some fond memories about the drugs that I did. You know, it's like, oh, that was fun. Well, I did it and I'm glad I don't do it anymore. But I never think of that with the alcohol. Alcohol became my best friend. It wasn't my only friend, at least back then, but it was my best friend. I wanted to spend most of my time with it. And I tried. I finished school and I went to New York. Since I've got a theater degree in theater, I figured I probably, you know, Phillipsburg, New Jersey, which is where I'm from, wasn't the place to be. So I moved in the city, and I discovered how hard it is to break into the theater. Did a lot of freebie stuff. You know, got a job in different places. Did the mandatory waitressing, bartending. That got to be fun. But where my alcohol took me was I ended up designing lights in gay bars. I had a female singer, and she was doing the gay bar circuit in terms of cabaret stuff. And so I started designing lights for her. And one of the things I discovered was hanging out in a gay bar was pretty cool because I had a bunch of big brothers that took real good care of me, and it didn't matter how absolutely smashed, stinking, dumb, it didn't matter. You know, I just had a bunch of big brothers, and they all took care of me. And I had a lot of fun. I really did. Alcohol wasn't, it was beginning to be a problem, but it was a lot of fun while I was doing it. I still kept trying to do the same things, and my life started to go down the tubes a lot. The guys kicked me out because they kept saying, you're complaining that you're lonely. You're not meeting anybody. It's a little hard to meet a guy in a gay bar. So they kicked me out. And I was living in the village at the time. And so I started hanging out in the bars down there that weren't gay, but I was doing the same things. While I was safe in the uptown bars with the guys, I wasn't safe down here. And I ended up in a whole, you know, this is where it really starts spiraling down. I ended up in a whole bunch of less than nice situations. You know, I found myself in Brooklyn one night, found myself in Jersey one night with somebody in a car who got stopped by the cops, and I'm I don't even remember what town I was in, but it was one of the few nights that I wasn't drinking, because I had been sick, and so I ended up not drinking. They put the guy that I was with in jail, and they put me on a bus back to the city, and I'm trying to figure out what the heck I'm doing. This, like, even not drinking, I am getting into the same kind of insane situations. So it almost didn't matter that I was drinking or not. My behavior, my attitude, the way I acted was just as crazy. Those were the fun days. I left the city at one point, and now I'm into the isolation period, where alcohol took me, and at this point now, alcohol became the only friend I had. I moved here into Essex County, I lived in North Newark. I had a job down in Newark, and it was a pretty solitary job. I was working the box office at Symphony Hall, and I didn't have to deal with people except when they came in to buy tickets, but I didn't have to have a lot of interaction with them. That was good for me, or at least that's what I thought I wanted. I spent a lot of time, I did that, came home, drank. Went to work, came home, drank. And that's really all I did for about 3 years. I cut off everybody I knew in New York. I cut off my family to the best of my ability. They kept tracking me down. But, I didn't really spend much time with them. I didn't do anything but work and drink. That was really painful. It was a painful period because I didn't know how to be with people at all. It's sort of like everything said, I can't do this anymore. But I didn't have enough. I wasn't capable of trying to take myself out, but I couldn't be with people. So for about 3 years, I did that. And I always, there's a grace of God inside of me. I know there is. And I'm very grateful for it. And I've done a lot to try to smother that little flame or push that little seed of health, that little seed of God that I have in me, and cover it over. But every once in a while, it sprouts, and it comes up. And after about 3 years of my isolation, I decided that I needed to be around somebody. And I went and I took a course in first aid, and I met this woman who became a friend of mine and then a roommate of mine. She was working where she was working because she had her own problems with drugs. Had been a pharmacist who lost her license and therefore was working in the Red Cross. She didn't know how to drink. She never drank. She used drugs, but she didn't drink. And she wasn't using the drugs. She had no program. She had been arrested and, got clean but had no program. I didn't have a program at that point. I knew about AA, but I didn't have anything. I wasn't doing anything. I didn't think I had a problem. 3 years of isolation, but I don't have a problem. So we start drinking, and she learned real fast. She learned real fast. And in about 5 years, we did a lot of destructive things to hurt each other, I think. Not intentionally, but I worked nights, she worked days. I would come home at 11, 12 o'clock at night. I'd find her drunk. I'd be really, really pissed, burning something on the stove or having knocked something over and not cleaned it up. And I'd be really, really angry. So what do? I drank. So she got to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, and she found something that I did, and she'd get really pissed. She'd go to work and then come home and drink. So we just kept doing that. We kept feeding the anger in each other and drinking. I tell a little bit of her story because it's part of my story. As alcoholics, drug addicts, whatever, we are very good at, we're really good con artists. We're really good actors. And she had convinced the Board of Pharmacy that she was rehabilitated. So they gave her license back. And she immediately got a marvelous job in a hospital. Within a month or two after getting that job, I started finding stuff coming into the house that wasn't that, that didn't have any prescription to it. And I knew it wasn't, She said, oh, they're non-narcotic painkillers. And it's like, well, yeah, okay. Then I started seeing stuff that had to have a syringe to come in the house. And in about a year and a half after, a little less than a year and a half after she got this job, she had died of an overdose of methadone. Because as soon as she got back into her first love, she was gone. She didn't know where to go. You know, she didn't have a program to go to. She searched and searched. She was a woman who searched and searched for spirituality in all different kinds of religion, but couldn't touch it, couldn't find it. I didn't learn from her. I continued drinking for another 3 years after she died. It was about three or four more years afterwards. In the meantime, I had gotten involved with somebody really brilliantly. He's married. That helps a lot. That really, you know, satisfies my loneliness. I finally, you know, one New Year's Eve, my bottom for me, my surrender. As I said, I didn't know I was doing this at the time, but my surrender was not because I said I've had enough drinking. It's just I had said I had enough of life, and I needed to, I wanted to stop. And the only way I knew how to stop was to follow my roommates. She didn't do it on purpose, but to follow her example, but I did. I tried to take myself out. I knew that was probably going to happen because all of the stuff that Jane had brought into the house when she died, somehow I didn't want to get rid of it. There was stuff, you know, little things here. You know, well, you never know when you're going to need something. You know, I'm not using it like that. And this night I decided to take it, everything. Everything I could find I took, along with about a half of a fifth of vodka, three quarters of a fifth of vodka. I think that's all that was left. It was New Year's Eve. And of course, my lover was supposed to come be with me. He said he was going to, and he doesn't show. And so I'll show him I've had it. wrote my letters. Of course, I'm three sheets to the wind at this point. It was almost unreadable what I had written, but I had written a letter to my family, and I'd written a letter to, I think I wrote a letter to Bob, and I wrote a letter to this other woman that was staying at the house. In case she, because she was one who was going to come and find me, of course. She found me before I died, obviously. And I'm at the hospital, and I woke up somewhere around January 2nd. And the very, very, very first thought out of my head was, you stupid idiot, you can't even kill yourself. I say it was my surrender, and at some point it became my surrender. It was my bottom, but it hadn't yet become my surrender. I was tired. I didn't care anymore. I mean, you know, obviously I was not a success at killing myself. I certainly wasn't a success at living, so I just didn't care. And that probably was the closest thing I have to a surrender that I can tell you that I was very conscious of. It's sort of like, all right, I'm a tumbleweed. Wherever you send me to go, I'll go. Whatever you need me to, you know, that's fine. I just, no mind. I just don't want to have a mind anymore. You know, make it all go away. So, of course, they put me in the psych ward. I was going to AA. There was people coming in and bringing AA meetings in. And for this, I am very, very grateful for the 12th step and carrying the message and doing, you know, taking the work out, taking the recovery, and it's not just my recovery, but giving it out and giving it away, which is what the 12th step, so much of the 12th step is. I had heard a couple of them, and it's kind of in and out my ear, you know, I didn't really pay attention, but this one night, there were like three or four guys that came in. I don't even remember where they came from, I've never seen them again. But what I remember, and these guys didn't have any particularly marvelous message, I have to tell you. I mean, it was just the normal run-of-the-mill, let me tell you my story stuff. But what happened was one guy was talking, and he kind of made real close eye contact with each one of us. And he said, you know what, the statistics say that probably none of you are going to make it. I'm an alcoholic. Tell me what I can't do, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. And I got a fight back. I got something that said, the heck with you, no way. If you're going to tell me I'm not going to make it, I'm going to make it just to prove you're wrong. I don't know. You know, again, I believe that's the grace of God that came. I don't think it had anything to do with this man. I don't think it had anything to do with his message. I think it had to do with the grace of God and my just being tired enough that there was a crack in my wall and it came in. And I, you know, there was enough of the crack in my wall for God to come into my life and let me listen. And so I started asking where the meetings, and I got out at 5 o'clock on a Tuesday, and I walked into my first meeting at 8 o'clock on a Tuesday, about a mile down the street in South Orange. And they surrounded me, and the first person that I met at the door was standing at the door greeting everybody. He was greeting everybody in 1991, and he was greeting them right up until when he died about 3 years ago. And he started, you know, "Hi, my name is Tony, this, that, and the other thing." And I'm going, my brain is not functioning. I just got out of rehab. I'll never remember your name. So he proceeded to jump up and down and start screaming, "My name is Tony. My name is Tony. My name is Tony." I said, "Okay, your name I'll remember. I'll remember your name." And I did. I became a very, very close friend of mine. And I still miss him today a lot. But he introduced me to the women, and I found the fellowship of AA in those rooms. And for about 3 or 4 years, I was in those rooms, and that was my home group. And I had a lot of fellowship, and it was wonderful. There's nothing wrong with the fellowship of AA. But after 3 or 4 years, I was having a bit of difficulty with my life because I hadn't changed that much. I had stopped drinking. But I hadn't really made any, I hadn't worked on my spiritual life at all. All I had done was stop drinking and made some friends, which is really important. But I needed to do something else. And my first sponsor that I had, she was my temporary sponsor, and then I asked her to be my sponsor. And she, you know, took me to a lot of meetings. She was a member of another fellowship, which she also took me to. And for the first 3 or 4 months, I was going to both fellowships until I said, "I got to stop one of these because either I'm going to drink or I'm going to eat." And figured I'd eat instead of drink. And I told her I would, I'll get back to it later. I couldn't do both of them at this point. It took me almost 13 years to get back to it. But at any rate, she knew about meetings and she knew about fellowship. She ended up getting sick and said, "I have to, you know, not be your sponsor anymore. I can't take on the responsibility." And I said, "Okay." She got me started. I had a network of people. The one thing that I am very grateful for her is she made me call people. I hate the phone. To this day, I still don't like the telephone. But she made me call people, and I have a network of people. I had a network of people. So I had friends. I had fellowship. I didn't have a sponsor, though. And I'm floating around for a couple of years without a sponsor, without any real, direction, except picnics and games and fun. This woman finally got a hold of me in one of the meetings, and she said, "Who's your sponsor?" And I said, "Well, I don't really have one." She goes, "Well, you do now." And I'm going, "Oh, okay." She handed me some tapes, and they were the Joe and Charlie tapes. She said, "I want you to listen to these." And I'm going, "Okay." So I listened to them. It sounded like a foreign language. I had no idea what they were talking about. I had never opened this book. That's not true. I'm sorry. I did go to a big book meeting for a very short period of time while it existed because it folded, and we read the stories. But that's all I knew about the big book. I didn't know anything else. So when she gives me these tapes and I'm listening to them, it's like, wow, this is different. This is new. This is not what I know about don't drink and go to meetings. 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, I'm hearing something entirely different. So she takes me through the steps. And it wasn't, you know, and there wasn't any barn burning light thing, you know, it really was a, pardon my French, it was really a half-assed, you know, going through the steps, but it was enough. Again, I have the grace of God in my life. I did just enough so I didn't want to kill myself anymore, or that I didn't want to drink. As I said, my first step, I finally understood what an alcoholic was. An alcoholic is somebody who has a spiritual malady. My spirit was hurting. I think there's no coincidence in that. Alcohol is also called spirits as well as, you know, God, because they're both higher powers. They're both very much higher powers. And I found out that I have the spiritual malady, and it manifests in both my body and my mind. And as I said earlier, I discovered that, you know, I'm an alcoholic not because I have a few family members. I'm an alcoholic not because, you know, I had problems in my life or things didn't go my way or that I wasn't living happily ever after. I found out I was an alcoholic because when I put alcohol into my body, the one thing I am 100% absolutely sure of is that I'm going to have more alcohol. How much more, I don't know, but I am going to have more. And the mental part of it is I can't stop thinking about it when I'm not drinking it. I'd be at work when I was still drinking. I'd be at work saying, I'm not going to drink today, or I'm not going to drink until I get home, because I was a good drinker and driver. I couldn't make it from Woodbridge to West Orange without stopping at a liquor store and getting my little two, I had to get two of them, cocktails for two. But I had to have two of them because it took me that long to drive home. And, of course, by the time I finished the two of them, I wasn't driving really well. I wasn't driving terribly, but I wasn't driving well. You know, it's like I was definitely impaired. And that's all I needed to start drinking more when I got home. I went through periods. I never was a drinker that, I never was a daily drinker. But I was a daily thinker, and I thought about it daily, even if I didn't drink it. I could go to a party, I could go to a wedding and not drink, and not make a fool of myself. As long as I knew that there was a bottle at home, I could control it. I'm sure that, you know, given enough more time, I would have not been able to do that too. But I came in at the point where I could go to a wedding, I could go to a party, I could have one or two drinks and not go any further, but I knew I had to have a bottle at home. So I've got the spiritual, you know, I've got the spiritual malady, I've got the allergy because I don't know how much I'm going to drink, and I've got the mental obsession because I can't stop thinking about it. So that was slammed home to me, and I understood that. So once I, you know, once they basically tell me I'm screwed, it's sort of like, okay, now what? So she said, you go to step two. And I always had a higher power in my life. I always believed in God. I was raised as a Catholic. I went to Catholic school for 13 years. The nuns pounded it into my head. And my God basically still is a very Catholic God. It's very traditional in some ways. I've tweaked it here and there. But, you know, it's pretty much, I've always had a God in my life. My problem was not that I didn't believe in God. I didn't think God believed in me. I didn't think that he cared enough about me. I wasn't important enough. I was just this tiny little speck. And he had all these other important things to think about. I had to get past that. I had to get past the fact that, you know, I had to come to believe that there is a God who is going to restore me. Not just, you know, the general me, but the specific me, Kathy, to sanity. It took me a little time. It took me a little bit of time, but, you know, I guess I did come. I already came with God in my life. I just had to believe that he believed in me. We did the third step. She had me get down on my knees. And we prayed the third step together. I'm not sure I understood the entire implication of all of that at the time I did it. It's a good thing I didn't understand the implication of all of that at the time I did it. I'm turning my will and my life over. Since then, and having listened to a lot of people and gone to a lot of studies and participated in a lot of studies. Lee didn't explain it this way to me, but I understand it this way now. When I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I'm turning my thoughts and my actions. It's a lot easier than my will and my life. You know, how do I think? How am I willing to think? You know, am I willing to bring my life along God's will? That's turning my will into my life. It doesn't mean, you know, I turn it over and I take it back and I turn it over. I am willing today to turn my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. Yes, my own self-will gets into it once in a while. But deep down inside of me, the core of me, I have made that commitment that God has my life today. And it's, you know, really it is much easier. And when I can let it be that way, my life goes so much smoother. You know, it's when I get into it and I have to go, well, God, thanks a lot, but I think I'll take this one for a while. You know, and He lets me. And then I get pained. You know, there's pain. There's difficulty. There's uncomfortableness. And when there's enough of it, I kind of remember who's in charge. And I let go again. You know, and I just, you know, I it's always there. God is always there. But I just, every once in a while, I take it over. And, you know, it's a lesson I need to learn over and over and over again, I guess. Lee had me do the fourth step. And we did it in the columns. And the first two columns were a lot of fun. I enjoyed the first two columns. I even enjoyed the third column. It wasn't half bad, you know. You know, who was I resentful at? Well, Mom. She did this, and Dad, and he did this, and my brother, and he did this, and my job, they did this, and, you know, it's like, that's not bad, I can do this. And then we had to get to the, you know, and then the third column was, what did it affect? Well, you know, it affected my pocketbook, and affected my personal, you know, security, and all these things, and it's like, yeah, okay, fine. Then we get into the third column, where am I at fault? You know, how did I contribute to some of this? You know what? I found out that I contributed to every one of my resentments. One way, shape, or form. It was either the way I thought, the way I acted, what I did to start it. You know, having an expectation. They say that an expectation is a premeditated resentment. I had expectations that my mom is supposed to be, you know, my mom is supposed to be a certain way. My dad is supposed to be a certain way. I grew up with, television with Father Knows Best and Donna Reed, and, you know, and we're supposed to solve all our problems in a half an hour and we live happily ever after. So why isn't my family like this? You know, and, you know, that's not life, but that's what was going through my head. You know, why isn't my job bowing down and telling me how wonderful I am? Because you're not that wonderful, Kathy? You know, you do a good job, but wonderful is pushing it. You know, I had expectations of people that they were different than, you know, they weren't like I wanted them to be. Myself, you know, selfishness and self-centeredness, that's the root of all my trouble. They weren't what I wanted them to be. They weren't acting the way I wanted them to act. So I'm pissed. Once I started to see that I contribute to all of this, all of it, every one of them, I contribute something to. And I did need my sponsor because I couldn't see it necessarily, or I couldn't see the patterns, but which is where the fifth step comes in. But you know, I just, it really was not that great an inventory. It was, but it was as good as I could do. It was the best one I could do. I did try to do an inventory, and about 2 months sober, and I started to write my life history, because that's what I heard in the rooms, and I got about a page and a half, and I'm going, I'm bored. I can't do this, I'm bored. No idea what I was doing. So I stopped, and that was the extent of my trying to write a life history. Resentments weren't that, you know, I got them down. The ones I had problems with is I had problems with my fears. And even to this day, I'm still having problems writing down my fears, doing a good, you know, I don't mean to judge, I don't mean by good, but, you know, one that helps me get down to the core stuff. Because I have... I have a lot of fear, and a lot of the fear keeps me from writing the fear inventory, so, you know, or keeps me from being completely honest. I mean, I am as honest as I can be when I write it. I'm not saying that I'm, you know, I'm shortcutting it or anything, but I know that it's not it's not everything that I need. So I need to keep doing them, and particularly for me with the fears, because I've done a number of inventories, and what I'm finding out today is, in all honesty, I really don't have any resentments. Every time I have what I think is a resentment, it's a fear for me. You know, it's always a fear. You know, I'm not going to get something, or I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to get something I want, or I'm going to lose something I have. That's really what it comes down to. And then the third part of the inventory was the harms and sex. I needed to do some work there, because there were some harms I did in terms of the sex stuff. I'm not going into it, thank you very much. But there were harms, you know, there were harms I needed to look at. And there were also harms that I needed that had nothing to do with sex. Sometimes there are harms that I find, not often, but that I miss, or that are not part of a resentment or not part of a fear and not part of a sex inventory. But there's a harm there nonetheless that I may have committed. So, you know, that's what that last section is for. And I try to do it to the best of my ability. It's gotten better with each time I've done done a fourth step. My fifth step, the first fifth step I did, was terrified. Absolutely 100% terrified, because there were things that I wasn't going to tell anybody ever. No way, no how, uh-uh. And I did. One of the tricks I learned today when I hear a fifth step is I usually ask them right off the top of the, you know, we say our prayers, we start, and okay, now tell me the one thing you're not going to tell me first. And usually that makes it a little bit easier. But bottom line, you know, Lee didn't ask me that. We didn't start that way. So I had all these things, and there was that one piece that I wasn't going to tell. And it was like, finally I get to it. And she goes, spit it out. Tell me. And so I just kind of closed my eyes, and, you know, it's sort of like you jump in the deep end. And I said, you know, told her what it was. And she goes, oh, yeah, okay. And, you know, she told me her experience. And it's sort of like, oh, all right, so maybe I'm not that weird. I still felt weird, but maybe I'm not that weird. You know, it's like my scale of weirdness, I just kind of got a little bit better. Because now I think she's weird. Hers came down, mine went up. You know, we evened it out a little bit. I have since done other fifth steps, and I've done them in a number of ways. I've done them, and I found value in all of them. I've done them multiple, where I've given my fifth step to more than one person in the room. There were about five or six of us that were working through the steps. Ooh, Lord, it's got to be about 7 years ago, I guess. And we had a group of us that were working together, and this night, we had gotten to the place where we were doing, you know, working on talking about five. And there was one woman there who had never done it before, was really confused, wasn't sure what to do. The other people were there, and I said, you know what? I did it spur of the moment. I hadn't really thought about it, but I did pray ahead of time, and I got the idea to, you know, go ahead and do it. So I gave my fifth step there to those women, and there were four of them there. I got a lot of feedback. I got a lot of good feedback. I've had a fifth step that I've done with a man. Different point of view. Not necessarily everything. I didn't do my sex inventory with him. But I did most of the resentments and the fears. It's like you get a different mindset sometimes. I've done multiple fifth steps with different people at different times. And they've all had value. They've all had value somewhere along the line. And most of the time, it's either I'm directed to do it, or I'm you know, externally by somebody who says, why don't you try doing? Or, you know, internally, like the first time I did the multiple one with all the people. I don't suggest that's a good idea for the first time you ever do a fifth step. You know, because there's a lot of trust that you have to have. And I think, you know, you need to know that trust is there before you go do it. So I don't suggest doing that the first time. You know, you and the one person that you pick is a good idea, but make sure when you pick that you pick somebody that you do trust, that you are willing to tell them all and not hold back, because otherwise it's sort of, you know, I don't know, going to a feast with chopsticks. You know, you can't really dig in real well with the chopsticks. Maybe the Chinese can, but I can't. So, you know, be aware of who you pick. that kind of ended my doing steps for a while. I didn't get much further with Lee. We sort of fizzled out after the fifth step. She didn't push me. I didn't know where else to go. So what ended up happening was I kind of stopped there for a while, and I pretty much got as sick as I was before I did that fourth and fifth step, because everything came back. I didn't work on looking at and getting rid of my character defects. I'm only on 5 minutes. Quarter of already. Oh, dear. I went to a meeting. I found a meeting on Monday nights up in Berkeley Heights that talked about it and did it, and you know, it's called, the group itself is called Into Action, and that's what they're about. They're about action and they're about solutions. And I learned so much up there. I really did. I learned so much about the big book, about myself, about doing the work. And I asked a woman up there to take me through. And she took me through all of it. I started again from the top, and I finally did 6 and 7 this time. I looked at my own character defects. And I became willing. And that was hard. For me, some of the character defects were hard to let go of. Because for me, my character defects were my coping mechanisms. Those were my friends. That's what kept me alive. So for me to say, I'm not going to do this anymore, it's sort of like walking down Broadway, stark raving nude. And it's scary, you know. But I had to become willing. I had to become willing to do it. And so there was some prayer in there. And then we finally did our seventh step. And in the seventh step, as we say here at the end of this meeting, I offer myself, you know, my creator, you know, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I am in total package. I offered myself back, not only in the third step when I didn't know what I was offering, but I'm offering it now in the seventh step to God, good and bad, warts and all. And you know, I truly believe if I'm living my life, you know, in God's will, then I, what happens is God can take my behavior and use it, be very, he can do anything. My higher power can do absolutely anything. He can even take my character defects, my warts, my bad actions, and find some way to make them of value for somebody else. Maybe not for me, but for somebody else. As I look at it, when I'm being impatient and I'm laying on the horn because I'm on the parkway and I'm late for work because I didn't get up early enough, he's giving somebody else the opportunity to be patient with me. That doesn't excuse me from acting like I'm acting, and I understand that. But my God is big enough that he can take even my bad actions and make them worthwhile for someone. So that's what my seventh step prayer is about. He has all of me, good and bad. Now I got to do 8 and 9. Have to make amends. And amends doesn't mean, for me, amends doesn't mean that I get forgiven. It means I've got to make right what I made wrong. I've got to go and do my best to repair the damage. If it repairs the relationship, that's great. If it doesn't, that's not the point of it. The point of it is for me to make right my wrongs and to fix what I can. You know, if I owe money, I have to repay it. I didn't owe very much money. I wasn't that social, and I didn't get involved in too many things. So, you know, owing money wasn't a big thing. I didn't like paying. I mean, I did have bills that I wasn't paying. One of the things I had to, not because I didn't have any money, I just was scared. I mean, you know, talk about fear. I had, when I got sober, I had 3 bags of unopened mail, you know, regular grocery bags. Most of them, half of them were bills. Most of the other half were garbage, you know, just flyers and things that I didn't bother opening. But in that mess, there was a check for about a year that was a year old from an insurance company that I had, you know, gotten. It was like over $1,000. And it's like, oh, my God. You know, but I was scared to open it because I thought it was a bill. You know, and I just, even today, I'm not real crazy about doing my bills. It doesn't matter how whether I have the money or I don't. That's part of it. That's one of my character defects. I don't like parting with it. Like you said, I would be a wonderful gambler if I wasn't so cheap. You know, I just don't like doing that. And I do it. I do it because I have to. And I mean, you know, I have to be responsible. But so I paid those bills. I made arrangements and I paid whatever I needed to pay. as I said, it really wasn't that huge a deal. I had to make amends to my family, you know, speaking to my mom. And again, if, according to her, I didn't do that much because most of my drinking happened after I left home. You know, the biggest part of the amends I needed to make was for those 3 years where I cut myself off from all my family, and I wasn't there. And I need to be there for them today, and I do my best to do that. But I didn't create the havoc in the home because I wasn't living there, thank God. I was the good little girl in home. The one big amends that I remember happened actually only about 2 years ago. It was to my roommate, and she was already dead. And I had, you know, I had done a letter to her, and I burned it and, you know, made my amends in that way. And I thought I was finished. And one of the things that happened, she's buried down in Texas, and I went down to Texas for a visit to somebody else. And I made arrangements. I wanted to go down to the gravesite just to, you know, see how everything was, and because I hadn't been there in 10 years. And I got down there, and I had a hard time finding it. I found the cemetery. I couldn't find her grave. I was all over the place. I couldn't find it. I finally, you know, for about an hour, I'm driving around up and down, in and out, getting in and out of the car. I had an idea of where it was, but I just couldn't locate it. It was a Sunday, of course, so nothing's open. As it turned out, there was somebody there who was... There was a funeral the next day, and he was setting it up or doing something. And I said, "Can you help me?" And it turned out to be the funeral director who had buried her. And he took me back to and he opened the funeral home, took it back, and went into his logs and showed me where it was. So I went back, and I didn't know at the time. I had something I had learned with amends was to make sure that I ask the other person, "Is there anything that you need to tell me?" This is, you know, to living people as I'm doing it face-to-face with them. And I was moved to do that in my heart to Jane. You know, it's like, is there anything that you need to tell me? And here I am sitting at the gravesite, and for about an hour I sat there and I just cried because I got all of this information. All of this information kept flooding into me, like nobody's talking in my ear, but it's in my heart. And I realized on a much deeper level how I hurt her, how I, you know, how I harmed her. And the only thing I could do at that point was just, you know, there's no other way I can make it up except to say I'm really sorry, and that, you know, I will never try to do, you know, I will never do this to another person, to the best of my, and that's the only way I can make an amends to her because she's not here anymore. But, I really was moved to, you know, to ask that question of her, even though she's dead and gone and buried. I still can get an answer. And that's, again, the grace of God that's in my life. You know, he opens that door and lets the answers come in. That's kind of the extent of my amends. There's not really a whole lot more with it. My amends were pretty small, you know, in terms of there was nothing big and dramatic. That's kind of the biggest thing that I had. When it comes to 10, 11, and 12, for me to keep that fit spiritual condition, because I'm going to lose all of this if I don't stay here. If I don't stay in that, you know, because if I have a spiritual malady, I need to keep that spirit in fit condition. I've done all this work. It's sort of like, you know, you get in really good shape and you go to the gym four times a week, and you work out and you get in great shape, and then you do what you do and you sit back on your butt and get fat again. You know, it's like, why? You know, you gotta, you know, it's sort of like, if I did all this work to get into condition, and I need to stay in condition. And that's what 10 and 11 is for me. 10 is my daily, my minute by minute inventories, paying attention to where I am. And the best way I can describe 10 for me is to stay in the moment, stay in the now. So I'm always aware of what I'm doing. Because 9 times out of 10, I'm either yesterday or tomorrow, and I'm not seeing what's in front of me. And that's when I make the, you know, that's when I harm people, when I'm not in the present moment. You know, I'm thinking about something I did, or I think about something I'm going to do. I can't see where I'm harming somebody right now. So for me, 10 is staying in the moment and paying attention to what I'm doing. 11 gives us really good directions in terms of what to do in the morning, what to do at night. The prayer and meditation, it talks, you know, taken as a whole in prayer and meditation. There are more ways to meditate. You know, there's no right way to pray or meditate. You know, try it all. There is, you know, like my God has no boundaries, my meditation and prayer has no boundaries. I can try everything and anything. I don't stay with any one thing. You know, I do for a while, and then I try something different, because every time I stay with any one thing for any length of time, then it becomes rote. I was in a meeting, and I grew up with the Lord's Prayer. As I said, I grew up Catholic. I grew up with the Lord's Prayer. And for the longest time, you know, I say it. And it's like, you know, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom. You know, it's like it just trips right off my tongue. And this one day in the meeting, I think I was even down in West Virginia. I don't remember where, because it sounded different probably. I listened to the words, and it was like brand new all over again. Because I needed to hear it. I need to hear what I'm praying for it to be real for me. You know, if I'm just saying rote prayers and I don't pay attention to them, I get bored with them. Or, you know, not even bored with them. I just stop hearing them. They just become part of what I do, and I don't take it inside. So either I have to stop and listen, or sometimes, as I said, I change whatever practice I'm doing. And there are times I get lazy and I don't have any practice, which is probably right about now. I haven't been very good about my 10 and 11 practices, or my 11-step practices. I've gotten lazy. And I can see it. I feel the difference. I don't need to beat myself up over being lazy. I just need to change and do something different. You know, part of my being lazy, I think, is part of my being human. And if I beat myself up over it, then I'm putting myself down, and I can't do that. You know, I've done too much work, and God has done too much work for me to keep putting myself down. So I just need to kind of pick myself up and dust myself off and keep moving and do something. Get into some kind of action. And whatever it is, I don't care what it is. Just start. Just do something. Anything. And then lastly, the 12th step, as I said, that gentleman coming to the detox was doing 12-step work. He was carrying a message. There is, for me, nothing like working with another alcoholic. A friend of ours talks about this. He says that we talk about going through the 12 steps as the work. And he said, it's not the work. You know, going through the steps is not the work. It's the preparation for the work. The 12th step is the work. Carrying the message. Working with another alcoholic. You know, showing them the path that I was. That's the work of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not going through the steps. The steps show us how to do it. It prepares us to be there and be able to do that. Not, you know, it. The 12 steps, this whole program for me is not about getting sober. It has very, very little to do with getting sober. It has to do with getting a higher power in my life and then showing somebody else what that higher power is and how it works in my life, and that I can be happy, joyous, and free. And when I can do that, then I am doing the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether it's speaking or whether it's working one-on-one with somebody. But it's all about me and my higher power. Hopefully it's about my higher power in me. Let me rephrase that. So that I am not the first one and I am not the center of it. My higher power is the center of my life today. And from that stems so much that I can't even begin to tell you. You know, it's just, it really is, the life is, it's a life. It just is life. I mean, sometimes it's wonderful. Sometimes it sucks. Sometimes it's, you know, it's funny, and sometimes it's very sad. But there's still, you know, the fact that I'm here to be here. One of the joys I had tonight or this afternoon was, and it's a sad situation, but, you know, or circumstances, but the fact that I'm able to be present. A friend of mine's mother passed away, and, you know, the viewing was tonight and this afternoon. And so I wanted to be there. And I, so I took some time off so I could be there. I knew I couldn't, you know, I was here, so I couldn't do it at night, so I had to take the time from work. But the fact that I can be there, even though it's a sad situation, it's one of those life things that does suck, you know, and it's hard. But the fact that I can be present for somebody else and be there is what this is about and what my life is about today. So I can be there for a funeral as fast as I can be there for a party. And I don't know. I just, you know, I hope that the grace of God comes into all of, or is in all of your lives, or comes in. But, you know, let that crack open and let that higher power in, whatever it is, however it is that you understand that higher power, because that's what this is about. That's what the program is about. And I thank you very much for letting me share.